Thank you, Lee. It's very easy to run a college if you just remember the two simple steps of good management. Hire excellent people and take credit for what they do. I'm proud to be here with you. I thought Bill Campbell gave a beautiful closing, swan song maybe this morning, and he's going to publish that. I'm proud to be here with Lee, who's the historian of the conservative movement. I'm so grateful to him for his efforts to civilize his son-in-law and my colleague, Matt Spaulding. I'm proud to be here with Angelo, whom you probably know is on his third heart, walking proof here in the Philadelphia Society that the human soul is not a material thing. I was asked to join the board of the Society again for the second time before this 50th meeting, and I was very honored about that, and this time to become an officer of the Society. And since I was on the board the last time, I've entered the academic world, so of course I had to think long and hard before I said yes to the invitation. I had to settle the great question, is the Society sufficiently diverse? And I did settle it by watching two of the presentations today, one at breakfast and one on the last panel, all of whom were spectacular, I thought. I happen to have known these two men so long, and I'm going to compare them for you, and you'll see that we have the whole range here. And I say this without apology to them. I've known them so long, I can tell any story about them I want to. One of them is Bob Riley, whom I knew when he was a graduate school, and I learned from his remarks this morning that I met him the year he joined this society. And, you know, we never get over what we're like as graduate students. We just learn to control it. And the way Bob was back then was that he would stay up all night listening to classical music and reading great books. And I have a good memory for fine phrases, I claim, and many of them I remember from him. And so Bob would, you know, be up all night. I once saw him try to teach a girl to waltz, and she was so slow to learn that he used a conductor's baton to pat her on one side so that the foot would go down at just the right moment, so he actually whipped her into learning to waltz. And I also remember that he would show up bright and shiny every day, freshly out of bed for breakfast, lunch for the rest of us. And then he moved off to Washington, D.C., and he went to work for the other extreme that I'm going to mention, Ed Fulner. And he came home, we called it home back then, to visit us in Claremont, and we asked him what it was like working at the Heritage Foundation for Ed Fulner, and he said, "It's terrible." And I said, "Why is it terrible?" He said, "Well, you know, they're all really good and all that," but he says, "Fulner will call you in the morning at 10 o'clock. and ask you what you're doing. And I will say, what do you mean, Ed? What am I doing for lunch?" I thought it was okay to tell that anecdote since it's the 50th anniversary. And also, we do have the full range here of every human type. So Angelo argues that the Republican Party is corrupted by the wish to join the ruling class about which he's written with great power. And I want to disagree with him about one important point. His account of them is too charitable. It's a picture of a group of people who've sold themselves to get into high places. And my own observation of them is that rather most of them are confused. A lot of them are desperately afraid now. The ones in the majority, the ones in the leadership, they tend to become demoralized over time. They don't know what to do. The questions they face are so very large, and the forces against them are huge. They have not lived their lives in the way everyone here has lived his life. Think what brings us together. All of us made a choice at some point. We decided to try to find some stuff out. We decided to try to give an account of things. Many of the people in this room are people that I knew when I first made that choice, I had decided not to go to law school. Instead, I wanted to get an education. Excuse me, attorneys. Victor Hansen has written about George W. Bush, that for about 20 years in the middle of his life, he really didn't do anything very serious. He hung around the edge of a baseball team. Time passed. He recovered himself. He has a really great wife, and he found his faith more seriously and became what I think is a very fine human being. And now he reads 5 or 6 books a week. He talks about it a lot. And I wonder what the books are like, and I wonder if he really reads 5 books a week and understands what they are, if they're worthy books. So many are like that now. I told him an anecdote about George Washington. The Republicans will love that, by and large and overwhelmingly, and it will be unfamiliar to them. The effect of this is predictable. The people who've run for president of the United States since Ronald Reagan, and by the way, what do we find out about Reagan since he retired? Except that there was so much more there than anybody saw. All these things emerge that he wrote in his own hand. There's a book by Marty Anderson called In His Own Hand. And what he was doing, Reagan out at the ranch, he's well known now, he loved to sit at a table hewn out of timber with logs for legs with his cowboy boots on, and he would sit there and he wouldn't sleep, and he would sit there for 2 hours. What was he doing? Was he dull? He thought a lot. That story this morning about the rule of law, about the air traffic controllers, what could produce something like that? Except years of thought, hard thought. In the novel Lord Jim, it begins with an act of cowardice, and Joseph Conrad tells us through the rest of the novel that the reason that Jim committed this act of cowardice to save himself from a sinking ship instead of the people under his charge on the ship is that he had not played out in his mind what he needed to do, how to be brave, how to act when the testing place comes. Prudence is an exercise in imagination. You play out a series of pictures in your mind, first this one and this one and this one, and you can shuffle them almost like a deck of cards. And you can see what the various options mean. And if you do that all your life, you might get good at it. We teach the young at Hillsdale College, and we tell them knowledge is not a possession, it's a way of living. It's an activity, and it must be kept alive all the time. By and large, these are not people who have lived that way. And they're victims, most of them, of the fact that nobody's taught to live that way very much. A lot of them come from indignation and fear, and they just want to fix it. It's the reason why we think that if we had term limits, and anybody who'd run a business would be really good at this kind of work, because they know what the real world is like. What that argument means is there isn't really anything to know except normal experiences. But of course, statesmanship is very difficult. I had the great privilege of employing Bill Rusher for several years in his retirement, and he was so genial and so wise and so acerbic that it was wonderful to know him. And of course, in the 80s, we young guys who'd started the Claremont Institute used to always complain about Ronald Reagan, you know, how weak he was and wasn't nearly good enough. And Bill Rusher, when I was doing something like that, had the appellation for me, his boss, my boy. My boy, he said, you're going to remember this as the golden age. I do now. Churchill said that the ability of statesmanship is much rarer than the rarest and purest of diamonds. And because of that, wars are mainly tales of muddle. He said that the art cannot be taught, although it can be armed. I think we have to go into the armaments industry. Mitt Romney spent close to $2 billion, somewhere north of 1.7, I read, running for president of the United States. The average of who are the ones? Bush won, ran twice. Can't remember them anymore. Dole ran, McCain ran, and Romney ran. Am I forgetting any? I'm forgetting them all. And Coca-Cola, they advertise at a rate of about $2.5 to $3 billion a year, and there are many other brands that are advertised at that rate. And that means, by the way, that the amount of money spent running for president and the amount of money spent on politics in America is not anything like as large as what's spent advertising ordinary products. But still $1.7 billion, and I think the average of all those guys I named is $1 billion. That is a lot of money. And the first rule of advertising is actually the first rule of life. There actually aren't any other rules except the first rule. And the rule is, decide what you want to say and make it something that you give your heart to. Not in the way Angelo has given his heart, I mean your soul. Something you will stand or fall by. Something that you intend to do without fail. Something that moves you. Something you love the most, love more than anything. And if you don't do that, first of all, people won't remember what you say. And second, you won't be in any position to do anything if you should be so fortunate as to win. Reagan remembered that rule. I'll tell you how they run today. I have an anecdote about it. Everybody who's old like me knows Frank Shakespeare.